Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's December 2021, and this is episode 266, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the Apple TV series Foundation, based on the books by Isaac Asimov. Today's guest is Dr. Melissa Kane Travis, who serves as affiliate faculty at Colorado Christian University's Lee Strobel Center. She is also president of the Society for Women of Letters and the author of Science in the Mind of the Maker, What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God. Melissa has written an exclusive online television series review about Foundation for the Christian Research Journal. Her review is called Religious Robots and Other Curiosities, Exploring Philosophical Themes in Apple TV's Foundation Series. You can read this article if you're a subscriber for free at our website, equip.org. If you're not a subscriber and would like to read this article, please subscribe to the Christian Research Journal at equip.org. Melissa, it's good to have you on.
Hey, Melanie. Thanks for having me.
Today, we're talking about Apple TV's new series, Foundation, which is based on books by Isaac Asimov, who was a writer and also philosopher. So it's kind of interesting. There has been a spate of older work done in the 50s and 60s that are now making its way to the big screen. And if anyone hasn't already listened to our podcast on Dune, we covered that. And that was originally written back in 1965. So it's kind of interesting that there's this kind of resurgence of older sci-fi material out there. So for you as a Christian philosopher, why do you have a particular appreciation for science fiction, you know, as a genre that you're interested in?
Well, since my childhood, I've had a strong fascination with disciplines like astronomy, space travel, and the frontiers of technology. My favorite cartoon as a little kid was The Jetsons. I was just so fascinated by futuristic portrayals of the world and the general idea of futurism. So I'm a longtime fan of science fiction literature and science fiction television and film. But when I began studying philosophy a little over a decade ago, my love for the genre really took on a whole new dimension. So now when I read a sci-fi novel or watch science fiction television or film, I'm hyper aware of the philosophical themes in the stories. I just find it so interesting that a genre that's been long and widely regarded as the imaginative vehicle for naturalistic philosophy so often presents these concepts that are actually problematic for scientific materialism. So a good example of this would be the concept of artificial general intelligence, or machines that would theoretically become conscious, gain free will, and then surpass a human level of intelligence. And as the listeners probably know, that's a central theme of a lot of sci-fi films over the past several decades. And it seems to show up more often now than ever before, as we hear in science news that we're approaching the achievement of artificial intelligence, which is just a lot of hype. So there have been important strides in philosophy of mind and philosophy of artificial intelligence that really pose some intractable challenges to these beliefs that machines will just one day wake up and know themselves. And then some other examples of philosophical themes that aren't really unique to science fiction, but still tend to figure heavily into science fiction storylines, would include things like ethics, the question of human meaning and purpose, and none of those things can exist without a transcendent grounding. So if you have a vehicle that's materialist in its intent or themes, you run into some philosophical contradictions. So sci-fi turns out to be what I think is a really excellent subject for cultural apologetics, because it gives us such an entertaining and relevant starting point for all these kinds of questions, which can then naturally lead to conversation about spiritual matters.
I think you're so right about that. I think one of the popular pop culture sci-fi phenomenons in Star Trek deals with these things where, you know, people or humans can be basically good and any other life out there is all
goodness. We just have to find a way in which we can have unity. So there's all these very interesting questions that it poses that I don't know that any of these things sufficiently answer. So I always find it very fascinating. And also for our listeners, we've covered Star Trek quite a bit over the decades. You can also go to our website, equip.org, and search for that. So if you're interested in that series, we have some cultural apologetics on that. But back to Apple TV's Foundation series, what did you think of it, first of all? And is it a good adaptation of the source material, which, of course, whenever we talk about television series or films, people who are fans of the original material, usually books, are wondering, well, is this as good as Lord of the Rings, the books, or whatever it is?
Well, in the spirit of full disclosure, I have to admit right away that I've only read the first book in Asimov's Foundation series, and I just read it last spring when I heard it was being adapted for television. The book wasn't exactly what I expected. So I knew beforehand that Asimov was regarded as one of the big three fathers of modern science fiction literature, and I knew that his work had inspired some of the major themes in the Star Wars films, of which I'm a huge fan, and then a lot of other popular science fiction literature, TV, and cinema. So when I read the book, I was kind of surprised that it turned out to be this sequence of stories, and each story in the series had this brand new set of characters, but it was cohesive. It built out the foundation mythology, but it was just an interesting story structure for me. And as I said, not what I really expected. And as I reflected back on the book before the TV adaptation came out, my conclusion was, well, Asimov was a genius when it came to being a futuristic world builder, and he knew how to write characters in a way that gives the reader insight into their distinctive personalities and the motivations for their actions. But on the other hand, I was disappointed in what I see as Asimov's failure to tell a deeply human story. The narrative in the first book of the series, it sort of reads like this series of situation reports interspersed with these long dialogues between the characters, and it tends to get a little dry. And there was very little content in the book that inspired any feelings about the characters. As a side note, one thing that was very strange to me was the almost complete absence of significant female characters. It was just unrealistic for a story that's meant to be set in the distant future. So since I'm not really a devoted fan of the source material, and I know there are many major Asimov fans out there, I'm not a purist about it. And so I was very interested in seeing what the creators of the TV adaptation would do with it. And I think what they've produced is actually quite good. I'll say that the aesthetics of the show alone make it worthwhile. Even the opening credits are so beautiful that every time my husband and I would sit down to watch the next episode, we'd still watch the opening credits in full instead of skipping them, because they were just so awe-inspiring. Very well done. And then one of the major changes that's immediately noticeable between the source material and the adaptation is that they've gender flipped some of the lead roles. So we now have female actors playing characters that will endure throughout probably all seasons of the show. And the change is not, it's very thoughtfully done, in my opinion. You don't get this impression that it's a forced gender flip. I think that the roles that they've chosen to cast as female fit very naturally. And I think the writing is great. The prominent characters are deeply complex, which is important to me for a compelling story. One example would be the Emperor in the series, where he'll do or he'll say something that's just incredibly humane. And you realize, okay, he's not some two-dimensional villain. And then just as you're starting to think, well, maybe he's not really a villain at all, then he'll go and he'll do something so inhumane that it leaves you horrified. And then there's a similar dynamic with the characters who we perceive as the protagonist of the story, they'll do something that just frustrates you. Like, why in the world did they say that? Why did they do that? And that just humanizes the characters in the minds of the audience. So all of that to say, I think the adaptation is very well done. I think they've actually enhanced the source material, and I'm very much looking forward to the next season.
I agree with you as far as the production values are excellent. And I don't know if I was expecting that they would be as good as they are. I love sci-fi also. I love mostly, I don't read it as much as I've watched movies and television series. And people had said, oh, I should watch The Expanse. And I just could not get into it because I felt that the production values were so cheesy. I couldn't get beyond that. But this definitely has just gorgeous production value alone. I think it rivals a lot of what you see in really well done sci-fi films that are recent. So I think that they've done a good job there for sure. And I agree with you that seems like the trend is that happened in the Dune film as well, where they've taken source material that were male characters and they've made them into female characters. So I think that helps really just make a more rich experience, viewing experience. So what is exactly the central premise and plot of the show? I went into it not knowing anything about Foundation. I haven't read any of Isaac Asimov, even though as an English literature major, we didn't tend to read anything in the sci-fi genre, so I'm not familiar with his work. And so I went in cold turkey. I didn't know anything about it, and so I was trying to keep track of what was happening. It was a little bit disorienting at first because I didn't really understand the premise. It took a few episodes where I finally got a handle on, okay, now I know where the story's going. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the plot?
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that about being disoriented and trying to pick up the thread of the story, because I've heard others make the same remark. And by and large, across the board, I should say, those who have had that reaction are those who haven't read the source material. And so I think any listeners who have not read the books and not watched the show, I would recommend at least reading the first book, because I went into it already oriented to what the central premise would be. And that went a long way in helping me track with the story from the first episode. So the central premise involves this high profile mathematician. His name is Harry Seldon, and he's a professor of probability theory at this large university in the galactic capital of Trantor. And he's developed this scientific discipline that he calls psychohistory. And this is a blend of psychology, history, and mathematics. And he's able to use these tools to model and forecast the dynamics of large human populations, but he can't predict actions of individual people. They make that remark several times as they're setting up the premise of the show. So through his calculations, he has predicted that this galactic empire, which has endured for 12,000 years and includes trillions of people, is going to fall. He says it's going to lie in ruins within about 500 years. So he's arrested for treason, and he and his protege, Gail Dornick, who he recruited from this distant, anti-intellectual, primitive planet called Synax, they're interrogated by the Imperial Court at Trantor. So Seldon explains that the Empire is going to fall, there are going to be massive interstellar wars, and all these worlds are going to be destroyed, and then that's going to be followed by this 30,000-year Dark Age, and that will involve this huge loss of human knowledge caused by the wars. There's going to be technological regression, extensive barbarism, and lots of human suffering as a result. So Harry's plan is to postpone this inevitable Dark Age, make it less severe, and he's going to do that by developing what he calls a foundation, hence the title of the series. And what this foundation will do is they'll archive as much knowledge as possible into something they call the Encyclopedia Galactica. So according to Seldon's calculations, this will postpone the fall, and it will shorten the Dark Age to only 1,000 years. This encyclopedia, this archive of human knowledge, will essentially prevent the survivors from having to start from scratch when they rebuild the empire. So the acting emperor, Cleon the 12th, he's completely skeptical about Seldon's claims, and he's especially enraged by Seldon's call to end what's called the genetic dynasty. Now, the genetic dynasty is an invention for the show. It doesn't appear in the books. And I think it's a very clever and compelling plot device, actually. The idea is that there's been this long series of clones of the original emperor, Cleon the First, and these clones have reigned over the empire from this wealthy, technologically advanced capital for like 400 years. And at any given time, there are three Cleons living in the emperor's palace. Each one was decanted, I think is the word they used, from these big artificial wombs at different times. So you have a young emperor in training called Brother Dawn. Then you have the acting emperor, Brother Day, and then this aged, retired emperor, Brother Dusk, who is like the voice of wisdom for the younger Cleons. But I love the alliteration of their names at Dawn, Day, and Dusk. I thought that was very creative. So this genetic dynasty has created some political stagnation, and Harry's warning them that they need to end the genetic dynasty so that things don't go south very quickly and very badly. And they're skeptical. So at Brother Day, he's very skeptical of this. He's angry that Harry's calling for an end of the genetic dynasty. But then all of a sudden, there's this catastrophic terrorist attack that sort of wakes Day up a little bit, and he figures he needs to give Seldon at least some benefit of the doubt, because what he has predicted mathematically may turn out to be true. So he says, okay, you can form the foundation, but what he does is he exiles Seldon and all his followers who plan to work on the Encyclopedia Galactica, exiles them out to this planet called Terminus. It's on the far, far, far outer reaches of the galaxy. And they have to carry out their project there out of the public eye. The idea behind the exile is, if we get Harry out of the public eye where he could be a threat to the populace's confidence in the empire, it'll sort of keep civil unrest down. But it turns out, and this is a big spoiler, that being exiled was Harry's secret objective all along. So he wanted to set up this station of operations far away from the prying eyes of the empire, so that his real mission, organizing a rebellion against the Cleons, can just proceed undetected. And this launches the 1,000-year story of the Foundation mythology that will now be told through a proposed 8 seasons of the series.
Well, there's only 2 weeks remaining for this contest for a free subscription to the Christian Research Journal. How you enter is to write us a review, a short review. Just log into Apple Podcasts, search for Postmodern Realities, write us a one-sentence review, and you will be entered into the contest. There's less than 10 entries so far. If you're already a subscriber, still go ahead and enter, and you can win a free subscription for your pastor or for a friend or a family member who would enjoy our content. A subscription includes our print magazine straight to your door, as well as access to all of this exclusive articles and reviews and book reviews and movie reviews that are all on our website for our subscribers. In addition, you can just simply tell a friend about this podcast. The more people that know about us, the more people can find our content online. And you could also give us a tip if a subscription is not in your budget right now. We are grateful for any tip. $3, $5, $10, something like that. Maybe the cost of what you normally pay for a coffee out. You could give us a tip instead and skip a coffee for the week or the day. And you can do that by going to quip.org, hit magazine at the drop down, Postmodern Realities, and there's a link at any one of the landing pages for any of these episodes. So thank you for the ways in which you support the Christian Research Journal and this podcast, Postmodern Realities. I want to go back to something you mentioned in your recap for us, and two things. First is, you mentioned that this protege that
Harry Seldon recruits at the beginning of the series, Gale, comes from this planet Sinex. And it's interesting because that planet has, it seems like, has a religion that thinks that the pursuit of knowledge is evil, and anyone who has books or reads them are heretics. And so she has to deconvert from her religion in order to win this mathematical competition to become a protege of Harry Seldon. And you mentioned that he has created this discipline of psychohistory. Now, it took me a few episodes to figure out what that was, but do you think psychohistory is basically materialistic and deterministic?
Well, it seems that it could be taken that way at first, but my answer is not necessarily, because from the outset, Harry explains very clearly that his psychohistory model can't predict the action of individuals, only large populations. So psychohistory is this mathematical modeling system that's based on probability theory, but also past historical dynamics. In other words, observing how civilizations have behaved over the past, and then developing these mathematical models that are based on known data in order to extrapolate future data. So the idea being that empires inevitably rise and fall, there are certain cycles to history, and so on. So Seldon's model doesn't eliminate human agency at the personal level. And what I thought was really interesting is that while Seldon's model can't predict any individual person's choices, it can produce counterfactual information based on individual choices. In other words, if a specific person takes action A, the model suggests how that action will affect the whole course of future events. If the person takes action B, this other effect will likely come about. So I would say no, psychohistory is not meant to be taken as an insinuation of a deterministic materialism. It's just really based on projecting based on probability theory using known data from the past.
It's really interesting because it seems like he has put together this particular discipline of psychohistory, but you know, things happen in the series. It seems like his predictive model is not good at all. I mean, I don't want to have major spoilers, but all these major events start happening. And I realize he can't predict particular individual actions, but at the same time, there are larger, you know, groups of individuals that are planning against probably the empire that he doesn't even know about. And it'll be interesting to see how they tie up all of those particular threads. You know, address several philosophical themes that emerge from the storyline. And as you said, sci-fi is just a really great way in which some of these things can be thought about. And the first is something that you call intergenerational justice. So can you define that term and explain why it's actually problematic for the materialist perspective?
Intergenerational justice is this idea that we have a moral obligation to the people who will come after us, even people that will live in the very far distant future. If we're aware that actions that we take in our lifetimes will either help or harm people who come after us, the idea is that this creates a moral duty for us to do what we can to promote the flourishing of those future generations. And I think we can make a reasonably good case for this from scripture, both from the mandate to love our neighbors and from the Great Commission. So seeing intergenerational justice as a way to help facilitate the expansion of God's kingdom after we're all gone. So we could say that this idea has eternal ramifications for our own souls as we seek to love our neighbors who aren't distant in space, but are distant in time from us, but also in terms of helping future humanity flourish in ways that will facilitate the spreading of the gospel. And that's what I mean by having eternal ramifications. But when you think about intergenerational justice on the worldview of materialism, it really doesn't make much sense at all. you might have someone who has this intuitive sense that we have a moral duty to future people, but they don't have any genuine grounding for that sense of obligation if they're a materialist. We can ask questions like, why should we inconvenience ourselves or even sacrifice things that we want or need just to benefit people of the future who we'll never meet and who can't reciprocate any act of justice that we perform on their behalf? After all, if materialism is true, the human race is eventually going to die off. Life's going to cease to exist in the far distant future. So what ultimate difference does it make if we do not do things to help future generations flourish? And that completely leaves aside the whole problem that a materialist faces when they're trying to objectively define the concept of justice or just objectively ground any moral duty in the first place.
So there's another philosophical issue that's in the storyline, and that is the existence and the nature of the soul. And how is this explored throughout the season? It's interesting because before we started this podcast, I did ask you about that as it related to one of the characters who is an AI robot. So it's interesting to see. And you did say, you mentioned that they had a podcast that accompanies this, and I didn't know about it. And so our listeners might want to know about it so that they can listen to some of the choices that were made creatively about each episode. But just the idea of the existence and the nature of the soul for the different characters, and then also the AI character.
Yes, I'm very glad that you mentioned the podcast. There is an official Foundation podcast, and they have David Goyer, who is one of the co-creators and producers of the show, on every single episode. So what they did is they podcasted for every individual episode of season one. And what I'm telling people who ask me about Foundation is, if you make it a rather immersive experience, if you at least read the first book by Asimov, watch each episode of the show, and then listen to the associated podcast episode, you're going to have a much deeper appreciation for the creative decisions that have been made by the writers. But you'll also get some really good insight to their intent behind the dynamics of the storyline. And the existence of the soul and the question of artificial intelligence is one particular area that was greatly enhanced for me by listening to the podcast. So throughout the episodes of the show, the concept of the soul comes up repeatedly. It starts early on and it goes all the way through to the season finale. So first, there are hints in the narration. The show is narrated by Harry Seldon's protege, Gail Dornick, and she makes these comments. Some of them are rather subtle. Some of them are more overt, that hint to the fact that the soul is being treated as a Christian would conceive the soul, as an immaterial aspect of a human person. Now, this is definitely the case with the religion of Luminism, which is one of the major religions in the galaxy. It encompasses about 40% of the galactic population. So almost half of the galaxy is devoted to this religion called Luminism. And the Luminists believe that the soul survives the death of the body, and it evolves and goes through these cycles of enlightenment, death, and reincarnation. And so two major questions arise in the storyline, because you have Luminism portraying the soul in this way, but then the question of the soul is treated a bit differently in other subplots of the show. So you ask this question, well, do the Kleon clones have souls? A major plot point as the season progresses. And then another question is, does this artificially intelligent robot named Demerzel, does she have a soul? These questions aren't asked in the context of the Luminist religion. What I find interesting is that the writers of the show directly connect the issue of free will with the possession of the soul, but it's unclear whether they're identifying the soul with mere consciousness of having a self with inner experiences like emotions and desires, or if they're implying that the soul's an actual immaterial aspect of a person that can survive the death of the body the way the luminists believe. If they're implying that this robot, Demerzel, has a soul merely because her circuitry and her software have given rise to consciousness and free will, there's really a serious metaphysical problem they have to face, because we can argue quite forcefully that consciousness can't emerge from material death. I doubt they have a philosopher of mind on their consulting team. So it'll be really interesting to see how this all plays out in future seasons.
It seems like they need to take a page from The Good Place and have a philosopher that's part of the creative process.
Right, for sure.
Well, you talk about in your review that as human beings, we have this fundamental need for a grand narrative, a bigger, like a cosmic story. What do you mean by that?
Well, as human beings, we have this deep, essential desire for meaning and purpose. And those things don't make sense outside the context of there being some sort of overarching cosmic plan. I refer to it as a grand narrative. And to see ourselves as playing some small part in this narrative. In other words, the big questions of existence. Who are we? What kind of creatures are we? What are we doing here? Where are we headed? What's the ultimate point of all these things? And so we brave story or a grand narrative of our existence just to make sense of all this.
So in what ways does that particularly happen in this show? And what can we say about it from a Christian perspective? In a recent podcast about Squid Game, I talked about an article that was written that's on for free on our website about Hunger Games many years ago by Holly Ordway. And she talked about the importance of apologists to use non-Christian stories to explore the truths of Christianity. So can we use this non-Christian story, a foundation, to explore some of the truths of Christianity?
I think we can. That's a very good question. And I will say that the way we can use it in this particular context, the Foundation series, is by seeing how they emphasize this longing for story or the importance of understanding ourselves as being situated within a larger plan. Now, the importance of story was actually alluded to in the very first episode of the show, and I was struck by this scene in particular. Harry Seldon, when he's testifying before the Imperial Tribunal, he's trying to make an argument for the formation of the foundation that will carry out this Encyclopedia Galactica project. And he's talking about archiving all this human knowledge so that technology can be recovered and civilization can be rebuilt and yada, yada, yada. But at this one point, he says, it isn't just knowledge that we'd be saving, but humanity's story, our story. So what I see Seldon doing in that statement is distinguishing between the accumulated knowledge, or what we might refer to as the sciences, and the narrative that gives meaning and purpose to human life. Humans living in the far future will better flourish, according to Seldon's comment, if they understand themselves as a continuation of a cohesive grand narrative. And the thing is, we have to have reason to believe that this narrative matters, that it's rooted in a transcendent plan. But if we don't have souls that confer upon us things like free will, there really can't be any story of humanity. There's no meaning or purpose in the narrative if we're all just material automatons. And there are hints to these ideas all throughout the show in the dialogues scenes, especially those that include the AI robot Demerzel. She says that her luminous faith is how she seeks meaning and purpose, not the material directives that she's been coded with. She draws a sharp distinction between those two things. So the human need for this grand narrative is also discussed in the podcast. Again, I would encourage those who plan to watch the show to keep that in mind and listen to the associated podcast episodes each time, because David Goyer, one of the co-creators of the show, really fleshes this idea out. At one point, I think he even says humans crave narrative for their life. And I thought that was really interesting, since Goyer identifies himself as being a-religious. He doesn't use the label atheist. He talks about religion quite a lot and admits to having a deep fascination with religious ideas. So that makes me even more eager to see how these kinds of themes continue out as the show progresses.
So when you think about the human need for grand narrative, you talk about the power of myth that helps to shape the trajectory of human history. So can you unpack that a little bit for our listeners? What do you mean by the power of myth?
The way I'm using the term myth is in the classical scholarly sense of the word, a compelling story that explains important facets of the human experience, where we came from, what kind of creatures we are, why we're here, and what our purpose is going forward. In the show, this is explored through Demerzel's devotion to the religion of Luminism, but it also plays into Harry Seldon's scheme. He's aware that he has to inspire sort of a quasi-religious devotion among his followers in order for his master plan to succeed. So what he does, spoiler alert, is he stages his own martyrdom. Now, down through history, we see movements inspired by compelling figures, most particularly religious figures. And my guess is that the writers of the show are going to follow that theme going forward, with Harry regarded as this, or should I say, styled as this messiah figure. And that would actually be very consistent with the way Asimov shaped the mythology in the Foundation book series as sort of a religion in its own right. Even though I only read the first book, it was already explicitly stated in the storyline that was the intent, to turn the Foundation into something that garnered a religious devotion. And what's interesting about Asimov, he realized, and he discussed this in one of the essays he wrote near the end of his life, he realized it was impossible to just ignore religion in good science fiction writing. And for any listeners who are interested in that essay, it appears in the book entitled Gold, the Final Science Fiction Collection. It's very interesting to read Asimov in his own words. While he was so outspoken in his atheism, my impression is that he treats religion with a fairly respectful hand in some of his writing. I'm not an Asimov follower. As I said early in the podcast, I've only read the one book, but it would be interesting to see his approach to religion in some of his other stories.
So speaking of religion, it seems that it is part of the series, at least this first season. And, you know, I saw it portrayed in two ways. In one sense, you talked about like 40% of the galaxy follows this religion, Luminism, including this AI robot, Demerzel. But then I also mentioned that there was a religion on Synax where the protege Gale, she came from, and that seemed much more superstitious, and that things like science and knowledge were evil and shouldn't be explored. So in what light is religion portrayed? On one hand, you have this, what seems to me, a kind of matriarchal religion of Luminism, and then also the religion on Synax, which I don't know if they gave it a name, which was very much opposed to anything technological.
Yes, love this question. At the beginning of the show, our first introduction to one of the galactic religions, the seer church is what it's called. This introduction casts it in a pretty negative light. So it's on Gail Dornick's home planet of Synax, home to the seer church. And as you said, the faith is portrayed as extremely anti-intellectual to the point that they even execute people who pursue higher learning on the sly. And this would include the discipline of mathematics, which turns out to be Gail's major intellectual gift. And my first thought was that that scene was meant to make the viewer think about how various men of science in the real world were persecuted by the Roman Catholic Church centuries ago. But if you really pay attention to the backstory of Synax that's told later in the season, you learn that at one time they had a university on their planet with a scholarly library, and that the last remaining professor was a very close friend of Gail's family. And I found that intriguing. I thought, oh, the story's not as simple as I thought it was. They're not painting this big science versus religion narrative. And then I learned from the Associated podcast that what we're meant to understand is that the seer religion has actually been hijacked by religious extremists. So these religious extremists who have come in and they've syncretized all this superstition with the original seer church, and that's why they're actually executing intellectuals. So I was rather pleased with that explanation, that the subplot was not intended by the writers to cast aspersions on religion itself. But then we have this very different portrayal of religion in Luminism, and I thought the treatment was very respectful. As a viewer, you're not inspired to regard the Luminists as idiots by any means. In fact, one of my favorite characters of the series, well, I guess we could call her sort of a secondary character, is this figure named Zephyr Galot. And she's a Luminist leader, but she's controversial because she has she is an adherent to an ancient scripture that's regarded as somewhat heretical or questionable. But overall, she's a very admirable character who has these penetrating insights into the human condition and who's incredibly kind and a respecter of truth. And so all of that to say, when Luminism is portrayed, especially on their home planet, you don't have this impression that you're supposed to regard these people as anti-intellectual or as superstitious necessarily, just very devoted to their religious tenets.
So do you think, you know, speaking of the religion and how it's portrayed in this series, do you think that the show and the series overall is implicitly atheistic in its message?
At this no. The only hint in that direction that I really noticed was late in the season when Harry Seldon's explaining to Gail why he staged his own martyrdom. And he makes this comment about how you can kill a god. He says, you can kill a god, you simply stop believing in it. So we get this impression that Harry himself is probably a materialist. We may not ever find out for sure, but even in his psychohistory project, as I mentioned earlier, that doesn't seem to be based on a materialist deterministic understanding of reality. But I guess we'll see where the writers go from here. I hope they continue to portray religion with respect and that they avoid an implicitly atheistic tone.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have some fun rapid-fire questions for Melissa so we can get to know some of our journal authors better. So, Melissa, it is the holiday season right now, so are you Team Apple or Team Pumpkin?
Oh, Team Apple.
And besides philosophy and theology and apologetics, what else do you know well enough to teach other people?
Oh, that's a good question. I can teach people to
well, that'd be a great thing to teach people. It's a very popular thing that people want to know about. And finally, we're getting to the holiday season. So is there a particular gift-giving tradition or some kind of tradition you have at Christmas time with your family?
Oh, my husband and I, ever since we've been married, and we've been married for 23 years, our favorite thing to do is to buy a joint gift for one another. So it's kind of rare for us to have individual gifts under the tree to exchange with one another. We like to just pick out something really fun and get it for ourselves as a couple.
Well, thanks, Melissa, for being a guest today on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to episode 266 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. And today's guest was Dr. Melissa Kane Travis. She has written an online exclusive television series review article about the Apple TV series Foundation. Her review is called Religious Robots and Other Curiosities, Exploring Philosophical Themes in Apple TV's Foundation series. And our subscribers can read it for free at our website, equip.org.